Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Election Day, Tuesday, the 2nd of November. This is a very large story that keeps having updates every day, and it would probably even have received more attention had we not been in the days before a very large midterm election. The New York Times reporter, Robert Worth, wrote this in yesterday's edition or the day before. In the middle of last week, a 22-year-old engineering student, a woman claiming her name was Hanan al-Samawi, was at the UPS office in an upscale neighborhood of Yemen's capital city and dropped off a bomb hidden inside a printer cartridge with a Chicago address listed as the package's destination. A few blocks away, another package concealing a homemade bomb was dropped off at a FedEx office, also seemingly headed to Chicago. And within days, two packages advanced through four countries in at least four different airplanes, two of them carrying passengers, before they were identified in Britain and Dubai after an 11th-hour tip from Saudi Arabia's intelligence service set off an international terrorism alert and a frantic hunt. It was a sobering reminder to officials around the world that quick response to timely intelligence rules the day. Despite billions of dollars governments have spent on elaborate airport technology to guard against terrorism threats, the packages would probably have been loaded onto planes bound for the U.S. but for the Saudi tip. We're going to be taught, and it was later that I used that woman's name. That wasn't somebody had stolen her identity. She was released from jail because she wasn't the actual person who had mailed that bomb. We'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour. Robert Worth will be joining us, Beirut Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and we'll be speaking with Professor Charles Schmitz, professor of geography at Towson University. His interests include the political economy of development and development policy in the Arab world, international law, and the war on terror. He's also an expert on Arab politics and cross-cultural understanding and communication. He is a specialist on Yemen. We'll be joining you by phone if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address for you to reach us is talk@wpr.org. And we start with Professor Charles Schmitz. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
You know what's amazing about this, and I still wonder how people were able to find these packages out of all the hundreds of packages that are at these airports. Who alerted who that there were bombs in these packages? Was it Saudi Arabia, who's become really key in fighting a war against terror?
Your question is a very good one. My understanding, and perhaps Robert has a bit more of the latest information, is that the Saudis actually provided the tracking codes of the packages, and that's how they were able to pick them out so quickly. The interesting question is how they came to have the tracking codes. That was extremely fast. There was an allegation, there was an assertion that a former Guantanamo detainee, a Saudi, who after returning to Saudi Arabia, gone off to Yemen and joined Al-Qaeda in Yemen, had a change of heart, went back, I believe, in September, that he was the informant. But there's no way that he would have the tracking code. So that is actually a very interesting question. The question of Saudi Arabia, yes, Al-Qaeda in Yemen has a large number of Saudis, and they have targeted Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia has become very active in fighting Al-Qaeda in Yemen because of that, because of the fact that the Saudis are a target of Al-Qaeda in Yemen. So it's in their interest to fight Al-Qaeda in Yemen, to help in the fight against Al-Qaeda in Yemen.
Robert is joining us now. Robert is chief of the Beirut Bureau of the New York Times, which is a position he took in December of 2007. He was a foreign reporter for the Times before that, went to Baghdad in 2003 and was there until 2006. Robert, thank you very much for being with us.
Nice to be here.
This story, we were talking about who tipped off whom. This story has continual updates. Today's news is that there may have been a dry run for all of this in September. Can you fill us in on that?
Sure. I mean, apparently there was a package sent that included books and papers and other items from Yemen that they think could have been a dry run for this, you know, looking at how you can track packages and so forth, so that they would have been able to have some control over when, presumably, when a bomb might have detonated.
And how do we know, let me ask both of you this, that these are the only packages, two packages? There was remarkable intelligence done. Could something have slipped through?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I don't know the real answer to that, but I think they're looking frantically for anything else now. As far as we know, these are the ones that the Americans were, and Emiratis and everyone else were alerted to.
Mm-hmm.
That tracking numbers were supplied for those two packages.
We were talking just before you came on briefly about the role of Saudi Arabia in this. They were the people who tipped us off here. Can you tell us how valuable Saudi Arabia has been in helping identify terrorists and terrorism?
Yeah, I think they've been very helpful. I mean, this is a dramatic case that has received a lot of attention, but they, particularly when it comes to al-Qaeda's Yemen affiliate, Saudi pays a lot of attention to that, obviously, because Yemen is right next door, and they're very concerned about it with their own safety. And because a lot of the people in the leadership of al-Qaeda in Yemen are Saudis, who've been forced out of that country by Saudi Arabia's very strong and effective counterterrorism measures. So, the Saudis are very concerned about that, and all of the people in the list of 85 most wanted terrorists that the Saudis released last year were outside of the country, including some important ones in Yemen. So they track these people as much as they can all over the world, and therefore, for the past few years, they've been able to provide some really valuable attention, not just to the U.S., but to European countries as well, and in fact, in South Asia as well.
Mm-hmm. You write that in a recent article in The Times that they have been able to provide intelligence reports about imminent threats to at least two other European countries in the past few years and played an important role in identifying terrorists in Pakistan, Iraq, Somalia, and Kuwait.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they know this stuff better than anybody. They keep in touch with the families of these people. The Saudis have been very important. I mean, they've had their own experience with terrorism in the kingdom, and I think that really was what sort of caused them to pump up their counterterrorism program.
Mm-hmm. Professor Schmitz, can you tell me about a little bit about this Al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen? How large is it? Who are the people who are joining? And how Yemen has become sort of front and central now when we worry about terrorists?
It's not really well known how many there are. Estimates 300, 400, 500, something like this. Who are they? There are Yemeni. There are a group of Yemeni. There was a famous jailbreak in 2006, January, where some detainees got out and sort of an older guard of al-Qaeda. Two or three of those are key leaders now. There was an influx from Saudi Arabia, as Robert mentioned. I think it was 2005. The Saudis had a big confrontation, lots of fighting in Saudi Arabia, and they've clamped down hard, so there's refugees coming out of Saudi Arabia, and there's others now. One of the reasons that we talk about al-Qaeda as being in the forefront of the war on terror is that the al-Qaeda branch in Yemen, unlike many of the others, have a target of the United States. They've made a broad reach in their attacks. They tried to avoid fighting the Yemeni military for a long time, and they focused on the FAR war, and that made them somewhat different. But it also sort of is advertising in the sense that they're seen as the most aggressive affiliate, and so they get people to come, like the student from Nigeria, and they get some Americans have shown up there. And so, in a way, it's a type of advertising to bring in a wider group of people. Mm. And I've seen reports. There's been in the last 3 months, the Yemeni military has been sort of in an open field battle with elements of al-Qaeda in the south. And I've seen reports in local papers of villagers talking about foreigners going through the hills, going through the mountains and whatnot. And so clearly, this is the majority are Yemeni and Saudi, but they've got other folks that are in there as well. And why they're at the forefront, because of their reach, because the Yemeni government now is now in open confrontation with them, so that we see lots of fighting. The Yemenis have lost some 70 personnel in the military and police in the last, I think, 4 or 5 weeks.
Really?
Yes, the Al-Qaeda, particularly in the south, they started some drive-by shootings where they combine a motorcycle and shoot key security personnel and whatnot. So they've taken directly on the Yemeni state, and that's caused a lot of fighting. That's another reason that we see them in the forefront. And the other reason is that I think in the United States, in Washington, they're nervous about the Yemeni state's ability to take on Al-Qaeda because Yemen has both a political crisis and a economic crisis, which is separate from Al-Qaeda, and that the Yemeni state should be in a very weak position precisely when Al-Qaeda is making its move to become more aggressive, makes Washington nervous. And so there's been a lot of discussion of different kinds of aid packages of various sorts, both military and economic, to the country. And so this is really why we see it now as the forefront in the war on terror.
Hmm. But they didn't pick Yemen because somehow they thought the Yemeni government was okay with their philosophy. They didn't see him as a sure bet that hey we're going to look askance at what you're doing.
The Yemeni government, Ali Abdullah Saleh, the president, was picked out by Osama bin Laden as as an enemy, and they've said the Yemeni government is an enemy. But what they see in Yemen is a tribal society, and they've been trying to exploit tribal social organization and tribal sort of ethics to build themselves a place in the far reaches of Yemen. There's also the fact that Yemen, in the desert areas and whatnot, it's hard to govern. It's a governance that's sort of by proxy. It's not the case that the government only controls the city. I've seen that said many times. The government troops are in all parts of Yemen, and the Yemeni government has relations with sort of local powers, be they tribes or other clans or other sorts of social organization in the countryside and whatnot, but it's not what we would call direct state rule in that sense. It's rule through proxy and through alliances and whatnot. And so that leaves a certain amount of room in Yemen that the Al-Qaeda thought they could exploit.
I see. Robert, you've written some fascinating pieces about programs that I didn't even know existed to try to re-educate jihadists that Saudi Arabia is doing. Can you talk a little bit more about their counterterrorism program and how hard they have cracked down on terrorism?
Sure. I mean, there's two elements of it. There's the hard element, which is more familiar to us, which is, they have... They really, after they started seeing a really sort of a domestic insurgency by Al-Qaeda in 2003, a lot of people died, including a lot of security people. So they really pumped that up. I mean, I've been to the training centers where they work, and it's very impressive. They also really improved their surveillance so that they keep very close tabs on sort of telephone and email communications. But the other side of it, the side that's more interesting in a way, is the softer side, where they're trying hard to re-educate these people.
Yes,
and
I didn't know
that. That actually began in Yemen. I mean, Yemen had this program called Hiwar Fikri, Intellectual Dialogue, or Ideas Dialogue.
Huh.
And it was started, it was one of the auspices of a cleric and judge named Hamoud Hittar. And the idea was to sort of persuade these people that Islam, in fact, does not dictate violent jihad against the government or against the West or what have you. I mean, the truth is, what they really focused on was don't fight the government here. I think, at least in the beginning, they didn't care very much about whether these guys went off to somewhere else and did whatever they wanted to in Iraq. At that time, it was, in the early wake of the American invasion in 2003, it was, very, very, very popular to go off and, I mean, the idea, not so many people did it, but people supported the idea of fighting the Americans in Iraq. That program suffered an embarrassment when it made public that some of its graduates had, in fact, gone off and fought in Iraq. And anyway, it had never been very well funded, and there are a number of people who had been through it who said it was so paltry that it didn't amount to much. It was some clerics talking to some guys in jail and in halfway houses and sort of urging them not to do this. But Saudi Arabia picked up the idea, and they have, you know, they have obviously much, much more money, and they put a lot more into it, and their program is much more ambitious. I mean, it, for one thing, it just includes a lot of money. They can pay these guys, they can find them jobs, they can help get them married, and they also, you know, actually involves therapy, sort of re-education, but they really try to weave these guys back into the social fabric of Saudi Arabia. And that's one of the reasons why the idea of sending the remaining Yemenis in Guantanamo to Saudi Arabia to go through this program was something that never seemed destined to work because, you know, they're foreigners in Saudi Arabia. The whole point of the Saudi program is to bring these guys home and make them feel that they belong and that the government is their friend.
Oh, that's interesting. Please do a long piece on that. I find that absolutely fascinating, and we don't know very much about it. I'd love to read more about it. We have a ton of people who would like to speak with both of you, so we're going to go to phone calls. We have two guests with us. Robert Wirth is with us for the first half hour. He is Beirut Bureau Chief for the New York Times and has written extensive and very thorough and extremely interesting articles about all this in the Times. Charles Schmitz is also with us, Associate Professor of Geography at Towson University, and he is an expert on Yemen and also on development economy policy, rather, in the Arab world, international law, and the war on terror. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our lines are filled. Keep trying. And our email address, if you'd like to go that route, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As you well know, we have a big election going on today, and Wisconsin Public Radio will be presenting the results tonight. We do superb election coverage, and because there are so many state races and important state races, we have bureaus all over the state, reporters all over the state, so this is the place to be to get the vote totals and also to hear from the people who win and the people who lose. That's tonight at 7. Let's go to phone calls. Phil is calling from Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Hi, good morning. I have a quick question for you and a comment. My question is, we internationally ship. I own a small company, and my boxes on a fairly regular basis come in on what I'll call security or TSA tape. The boxes have been opened, inspected, and resealed, and I receive a letter to that effect. Am I on a watch list, or what's happening there? My comment is, having shipped before the internet and barcoding system existed and shipped since, I got to say one of the big heroes in this is barcode tracking, because I got to tell you, 15 years ago, it was nothing for a box to vanish from the face of the earth and never be found again before there was a barcode tracking system.
Robert, you want to take this?
I have to say I don't know much about the cargo system. That's not really my end of it, so I'm afraid I can't really contribute much to that.
Yeah, but the holes in the system, the security of cargo flights, tell me about what has been done to change that since the news of last week.
Well, I mean, certainly in Yemen, they've closed down these offices, and they've stopped flights to a lot of countries. I think, you know, people are taking a much closer look at what's going on. But I think, you know, it certainly has exposed an issue that until now, almost all of the attention was focused on your flights and very little on cargo. So they're looking at how to change that. The trouble is that if you vastly expand the security measures, you can really hurt that business economically, and I'm not sure they have an answer to that yet.
Mm-hmm. And do we have any idea at this point in time, I'm sure you're working this story, but when these were planned to go off, or if they were planned to go onto passenger jets or cargo ships, or what the ultimate idea was here?
I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions here, but they seem, based on what we know so far, to have been intended to explode on planes and not at the destinations they were sent to in Chicago, because they had timers on them, but which were taken from a part of a cell phone, the sort of board of a cell phone. But they didn't. They were not. There were no SIM cards. So in other words, you could not have detonated these using a cell phone.
I see. Anything you want to add to that, Charles?
Yeah, there was something that. My understanding is that these boxes did go through X-rays. They did go through scans, and they got through. which is one of the things that it's a signal that the bomb mater was very good. He was very good at what he was doing. He knew that they were going to be viewed, and they went through. And they went through in places other than Yemen. So it's a little bit strange that they shut down Yemen, but they don't shut down the other places that that it went through. I mean, I understand it's like grounding the planes in the United States after 9/11. They're just making sure. But, you know, those boxes, they made it through other scans on the way out. So, yeah, and then the big question, of course, as Robert says, is the economic impact.
Mm-hmm. And, Robert, I know you have to leave soon. What about trying to find the people who made these bombs and were responsible for this? I know that they have found, according to your reporting, the woman who was trying to mail one of the packages from Yemen, it was somebody had taken her identity, and she was released from jail. What kind of effort is going on right now to find the people who did this?
Well, I think it's essentially the same kind of effort that was being made before. I mean, the Yemeni security forces and counterterrorism forces have really stepped up their efforts since about a year ago. When it just became clear that al-Qaeda had dramatically increased its activity and was also targeting the president and his family. And that's when you saw a series of American airstrikes for which the president gave permission, as well as a lot more effort by Yemeni army and police and so on. But what's going on, they're trying to track down al-Qaeda members. They're particularly interested in Ibrahim al-Asiri, who's appears to be the chief explosives maker and the guy who they think was probably behind this, although al-Qaeda has not, you know, officially taken credit for this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we know where he is, although, you know, al-Qaeda generally seems to operate in these four provinces that are to the east of Sana'a, the capital, from Al-Jawf, which is up in the north, all the way down to Abyan in the south. And a lot of the activity lately has been down in the south.
Yeah. Thank you, Robert, very much. I know you got a busy assignment here. Thank you for joining us. Charles is staying with us. Robert Worth, Beirut Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Can you add to that, Professor Schmitz? Do you know what efforts are going on to find these people?
Oh, they've been after them for a long time.
Mm.
Even before the events that Robert referred to a year ago. I mean, really, the Yemeni started fighting in 1995. Islamic extremists, ones that wanted to fight the government. And they had pitched battles in the south in 96 and 98. This is not a new thing. The finding of a guy like that, I mean, the difficulty is that, you know, he could be in Sana'a. He could be in the capital as well. And they have had they have taken down some al-Qaeda members inside the capital. It's very difficult to track. I remember that you know, 9/11 was planned and sort of put together in Hamburg. So you know, this is difficult to do. And in the difficulty in Yemen is that you can have people in the far desert who are sort of out there, you know, training with weapons and putting together plans and whatnot, and they go unnoticed. I mean, they're not seen, and it's difficult to track them. The Yemeni government has made tremendous effort, as Robert said, in the last year to really track down. And the last 4 weeks have been particularly bloody out there as they've been fighting pitched battles in urban and desert areas.
Mm. Let's go to Jim from Pleasant Prairie, our next caller. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning. But you know, I'm hearing another show about another incident, and I would like to talk about a fact which you're discussing and how to stop it, but what about the cause? Perhaps U.S. foreign policy needs to be debated in a trial. An example, Saudi Arabia has already been mentioned several times, but you know, Saudi Arabia as a state, and this applies to much of the Middle East, only exists because of deals that were brokered with the West. We ought to think about the massive military presence of the United States, such as Iraq, 14 military bases. We are the practically the sole supplier of Israel. The Mediterranean fleet that has fighter bombers ready at a moment's notice. I mean, how would we respond if a Middle Eastern empire were occupying much of North America?
Professor Schmitz.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think about, you know, these two bombs that were sent towards the United States, and I think what people in the United States need to understand is that the Yemenis sort of feel the same way inside of Yemen. When the news of the bombs first came out, what Yemenis were most concerned about was an overreaction by the United States inside of Yemen, because Robert mentioned a couple of air attacks that happened about a year ago. In one of those attacks, there were about 50 civilians that were killed, innocent civilians. And then there was another predator attack that happened. There was a powerful sheikh in the east who was going out to negotiate the surrender of some al-Qaeda members in the tribal area. And he was returning from the meeting, and he got hit by the predator. He was killed by the predator missile. And the president of Yemen took great heat because, you know, clearly somebody had made a mistake, and it was the Americans that were shooting the missile. And so there was a question of sovereignty and authority and who's running this. And so the Yemenis sort of feel the same thing when Americans take military action. You know, do they know what they're doing? Are they going to hit the right people? Are they going to hit innocent people? Because it is a question. And then in terms of the military, I would disagree with the callers describing Saudi Arabia as a result of deals with the West. Saudi Arabia is its own power. It certainly made you know, deals with Western oil companies, but it is its own power. It was for that.
Mm-hmm.
But the question of the military, I mean, that's being debated right now in regards to Yemen. There's a fight between the State Department and the Pentagon. The Pentagon wants to massively beef up the Yemeni military, whereas the State Department wants to concentrate the military on anti-terrorism, simply give sort of targeted capabilities to the Yemeni military. And the issue is the Yemeni government. Everybody is in favor of going after terrorists, but the fear is that the Yemeni government would go after its political enemies. And it has two large opponents right now, one in the south, a group of people who would like to set up a separate state. South Yemen was a separate state, and there's a large number of people who are in favor of secession again. And then in the north, there's the Houthi rebellion, which right now is quiet, but has gone through six iterations of warfare. And the fear is that the Yemeni government would use that massive buildup against its political opponents, which is the general criticism against U.S. intervention in the Middle East, that we support regimes that are repressive. You know, Saudi Arabia is no democracy, and they're not into... Robert talked about their ability to monitor. Well, they do that because there is no civil liberties. You know, they have much wider leeway, things that we couldn't do in this country. There's a valid criticism, and we should think about our military presence there and think about the implications of us being a world power and what sort of buy-in do people in the Middle East have to an American-led global order.
Mm-hmm.
Have to think about that. That's very important. And that's why, in the case of Yemen, economic aid is very important, so that Yemenis recognize that we are interested in them and not just in killing terrorists.
Let's go back to Saudi Arabia for a moment. Robert wrote recently that, which seems to me as though this is fairly significant, public opinion, once relatively supportive of figures like bin Laden, has shifted decisively since al-Qaeda began killing Muslims on Saudi soil. 85 wanted militants, a list was released by the Saudi Interior Minister. All of them were outside the kingdom, including some in Yemen. Saudi Arabia's problem has become the world's problem. A couple questions come from that. One is, how decisive has been the shift against al-Qaeda in places like Saudi Arabia and perhaps in Yemen and other countries? Is it more difficult to recruit people now? And I wanted to do a follow-up when you were mentioning 200-400 people who were supporters of al-Qaeda in Yemen, whether or not that strikes you as a low number or a high number. So there are a lot of questions involved there, but take any part of them.
Okay. Bin Laden was a hero in the sense that, you know, he was a mujahid. He was one of the Afghani fighters. And, you know, like the mujahideen for Charlie Wilson, in the mm-hmm. United States, they were anti-communists. In Saudi Arabia and in much of the Arab world, the mujahideen were sort of, you know, Muslim heroes. They were fighting the oppressors. It took a while for the Arab world to come around to the idea that they were terrorists, in the sense that There was a lot of support for heroes, but then to see them as doing things that would not be supported, of killing civilians, for example, it is not supported, in sort of local custom, tribal custom. It's not supported in Islam. And to see them really as destructive. Initially, there's a bit of defensiveness because there is a feeling in much of the Middle East that that Islam is targeted by the United States. The president, all presidents of the United States always say that the war is not against Islam. But, they read the U.S. press, they hear things from the U.S. press, and so, there's a feeling that there's a certain amount of hostility towards Islam. And so they take statements from the United States with a grain of salt. They're worried when they start attacking Islamic organizations, whether they really know what they're doing and whether it's out of sort of a bias against Islam or whether it's against, good information. As the Afghani Arabs came back to the Arab world, and started causing trouble within the countries, and particularly started fighting their governments, then people got a more clear taste of what these people were about. And so their destructiveness. I mean, Al-Qaeda's program is they're a lightning rod for protest, but their program is to blow things up. And people are not into blowing things up. People want progress. They want, progress in the economy, progress in politics. These are the issues that people are interested in. And so Al-Qaeda doesn't gain much ground in that sense.
Right.
To the supporters of Yemen, it wasn't the organization what I was listing. There have been estimates of 200, 300, 400, 500 in terms of these are the members of the organization. These are the activists in the organization, not supporters.
I see.
The question of support is a difficult one, or it's one you have to be careful about because. For example, in Yemen, you'll have members of a tribe who are Al Qaeda members. They've gone off. They come from a tribal area. They go off. The tribe will, like in the south, the tribe will protect them, but not as Al Qaeda members, but members of the tribe. And this happened. This is what's happening with Al-Awlaki, for example. He's in the Awlaki, which is a powerful southern tribe in Shabwa, and in parts of Abyan. He's being protected because the tribe sees the government as oppressive, and they say that if Al-Awlaki has done something wrong, he should be put before a court. He should have due process. He shouldn't be assassinated. That assassination is illegal. And they're upset with the Americans, with Obama, about this. And so it's not on the basis of them being supporting Al-Qaeda. Tribes are not ideological. They're very practical. So we have to be careful when we say supporting. They're not supporting Al-Qaeda, but they may be protecting people because they see what's being done to them as oppressive. And I've seen, in the eastern tribal areas further north that Robert mentioned, tribal sheikhs have said, we are, on the one hand, we are not the an arm of the Yemeni security apparatus, but we also are not going to protect somebody if he's done something wrong. And if he's done something wrong before the state, then the state has its security apparatus and they can come get them. We're not going to interfere with them.
Uh-huh.
And that's somewhat of a shift. I mean, they're beginning to realize
that
it is quite is destructive, and they don't want people who are bringing wanton destruction among them.
Right. Stephen is next from Middleton. Hi, Stephen.
Yeah, that's quite a lecture, Professor. But let me bring up a point based on the evidence that we've learned about so far. This looks like an inside job. Saudi intelligence knowing the number of the package and where it was, so forth. It's a typical U.S. CIA-orchestrated frame-up and inside job designed to get us all hopped up about Yemen so we can start throwing drone missiles and nighttime death squad raids in Yemen, just like we're doing in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So the U.S. CIA is behind all of this. Just examine the evidence, folks.
Well, yeah. Packages were also found in England, right?
The fact that they had the tracking codes for these packages is very suspicious to me, and I don't know about whose conspiracy it is, but I certainly have some questions about how this thing was found out. It does seem quite suspicious to me. As to the question of shooting the drones, I do fear that in the sense of this could be an interagency fight within the administration, within our sort of intelligence and military branches, to sort of step up attacks. And I think what needs to be pointed out and argued forcefully is that they have not been very effective in the past so far. that, you know, right now the Yemeni security and military is taking the brunt, and they are fighting hard, and their intelligence apparatus is getting stronger, and that they are probably the people best suited to deal with this, and that are the Predator program, which they claim is effective in Pakistan, has not been in Yemen so far.
So let's just play this out a little bit more. You're suspicious of the tracking codes and getting that information because what does that indicate?
How did they get that intelligence? You know, who got it? And why, if they had that intelligence, why did they let the bombs fly on the planes? I find it, you know, they have been searching for these guys. They've been fighting these guys. Some of these guys, as I said, have been around for quite some time. To be able to get that level of information that quickly, you know, they said it came from somebody who defected in September.
Right.
Well, that guy could not have had that information. You know, the tracking codes you only get when you turn the package in. So, you know, it's strange. I would have some questions about it. I want more answers, as the caller does as well. I want more answers on that one.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I don't know where the finger points, but we need more answers.
Let's go next to Dwight from Wausau. Hi, Dwight.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, that is an interesting thing about those tracking codes. You know, one would think that if you had somebody on the inside that could gather intelligence, that certainly they would have alerted the officials before the packages actually got in the mail to any place. That part doesn't make sense at all to me. But that isn't why I called. A while ago, our president announced that he was going to increase the foreign exchange student program to those regions of the world, as well as bringing or sending our students abroad. Doesn't that, although it might afford some good feelings on the part of those that are promoting this, doesn't that in fact probably promote even a bigger chance that we would receive some unsavory individuals here in our country, as well as having some of our students being influenced abroad and then bringing that back home?
I think the benefits far outweigh any negative impact of a student exchange. I'm very strongly for increased student exchange. Some of the top Yemeni officials that are trying to implement reforms in the economy and in politics have been educated in American universities. The chance for American students to go to Yemen and actually meet Yemenis and learn about Yemeni culture and history is very important to us, particularly when, you know, our foreign policy often seems to be sort of flying in the dark, that if we have greater knowledge of the country, intimate knowledge of the country, we're far better off in that sense. There are some outstanding cases where, you know, students like Syed Qutb was a student in Colorado where there's a negative experience. But I have found in my travels and my talking with Yemenis that coming to the United States is a very beneficial experience. For example, I'll just give an example. I was once sitting with a group of Yemenis, and they were talking about how the United States is secular and that people are not religious. And suddenly from the corner, a guy popped up, and he said, no. He had been a Fulbright scholar, and he had gone to the United States, and he had stayed somewhere, I don't know where it was, Idaho or someplace off there, with a very conservative Christian family. And he said, no, in fact, the Americans are extremely religious. And so that was a corrective. You know, it's a misperception in the Middle East that the Americans are not very religious, and in fact we are, and this little student, having been on an exchange program, could correct them. I find that very, very beneficial.
More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, and our guest this whole hour is Professor Charles Schmitz. He is in the Department of Geography at Towson University, and he is an expert on the political economy of development and development policy in the Arab world, international law, the war on terror, contemporary geopolitics, and the issue of the failing state, Arab politics, and cross-cultural understanding. He is a specialist on Yemen. Our lines are open for you right now. They've been extremely crowded. Here is how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we are talking about the packages that were destined for Chicago, although the reports today saying that there was a trial run in September on these packages, and they were actually destined to be blown up in airplanes as they were making their way to the United States. The plot would likely not have been discovered if not for a tip by Saudi intelligence officials. And our guest is wondering where that information came from, quite specific, knowing the tracking code of these packages, and believes that we need to know more about that. So we're looking at this issue right now, which is worthy of quite a bit of our attention, and welcoming your phone calls. Our number again, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, we haven't had any of those this hour yet, so send us one if you want. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tonight at 7 o'clock, election coverage here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We have reporters at all our bureaus all over the state, and there are many important races, so you'll be getting not only a look at what's going on and what has gone on in terms of voting here in the state, but also information about national voting as well. So that starts at 7. Tomorrow, during many of our programs, I'll speak for our program, we will look at the state races at 9 o'clock tomorrow, and we will talk about the national races at 10 o'clock. Today we stay clear of politics because it is the day to vote, and we respect that. And tomorrow, we'll talk politics once again, okay? From the whole show tomorrow, 9 to 11. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Sarah is our next caller from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. About it being kind of suspicious where they got the barcode from, there's a couple things that struck me about that. Like, first of all, they were saying that if it was a full-blown plot, there might have been more packages. So that seems a little weird that there's only two, unless it was a dry run. I mean, I don't know, but that's just what I've heard. And the other thing is, if it was a conspiracy, but then they let it leak that there was a this supposed prisoner from Guantanamo Bay who gave out the tip, that just seems kind of incompetent to... Because then everyone came up with the idea, well, then where do they get the barcode? So if it was a conspiracy and they were trying to make us believe it was this Guantanamo Bay, it just seems kind of like they did a really bad job of it. So I just wonder what you think that might mean.
I have no idea. I mean, I think we have to wait and see what comes out. Initially in Yemen, they were upset that the Saudis had turned the tips over to Europeans and the Americans and not to the Yemeni. Because it was felt that the Saudi security didn't trust the Yemeni security. But in light of now, it seems that they had already left Yemen by the time the tip was given. So the Yemenis were not relevant at this time. I don't know who was trying to show who up. I don't know the motives there. I think we can only speculate, and that's not probably very helpful at this point. We have to wait till we have more information, if we get more information about this.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Considering the nature of all of this and secretive nature of some of this, will we ever know what happened?
Yeah. I'm not sure.
Why wouldn't there be, thank goodness they were discovered, but two bombs? You would think that it would be a little bit more massive effort on the part of people who wanted to cause harm here. Why would there just be two bombs?
Well, terrorism is political theater. They don't have to cause large-scale destruction. It's symbolic destruction. We can touch you. That's all they're saying. We can touch you. Fear us. That's all they're saying. So they don't need to cause a great deal of damage. They just show that they can. They have the ability to hit us. And the sophistication of the bombs was tremendous. I mean, those things were designed to get through X-ray machines, get through the
yes.
things that we have, and apparently they did. So that shows a great deal of sophistication, and so they really, even without them going off, they got their message across. We are powerful.
Right.
That's what they want to do.
Well, it seems to me as though, considering the fact that a lot of airports aren't ready for this kind of thing, that they could do this again pretty easily.
Well, I think that's why they shut down shipments coming out of Yemen, but, that could happen anywhere.
Right.
So I don't know what effect it's going to have shutting down Yemen in that sense. But it is scary. I mean, we have to go through a revamping of security at this point.
Yeah. And how long a period of time have they shut down packages from Yemen?
Well, they shut them down immediately. And my understanding is from Robert Worth's story that there is a team from the transportation agency that's there to help them work on vamping up their security.
I see. Let's go to someone from Madison, Randit.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to make a comment on the previous discussion about exchange. You know, I look at this whole terrorism plots and the attempts for Al-Qaeda to get back at U.S. as a manifestation of a breakdown. It's you know, we need the military option. We need to take care of the problem. But that's more like a surgery to fix a problem that has already manifested itself, versus the cultural exchanges, getting the students across. I myself came to U.S. on an ambassadorial scholarship, and after you come here, you understand the diversity, the large-heartedness of the people here. So I wanted to kind of reinforce what the professor was saying, that the student-to-student exchange, even though we might have some bad apples, is a great way to get that confidence building. And you know, for us to get an understanding of what others think about us and kind of share our culture with others so that there's a better understanding and we can eliminate this problem. A war won't solve this problem. Friendships will.
Professor Schmitz.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. That's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. So what information would you like to have gathered now? What would make you feel that the world may be in less danger, and what would make you feel as though we were getting at the bottom of all of this?
I would say two things. One, supporting the Yemeni in getting after Al-Qaeda. But secondly, as in the previous comment, understanding Yemen, and in that sense, understanding the problems that Yemen face, which are mostly economic and political. They have both a severe crisis of an economy and a severe crisis of politics. And the United States can play a very supportive role in solving that. And I would like to see progress in that light. I think there has been some progress, but the politics of Washington are such that the military measures have much greater significance than the economic ones, where I would say that the economics and politics are probably more important than in the long run. They are important, more important in the long run than the military ones.
We have some similar problems in the United States, though, don't we? Our economy,
yeah, I mean,
and politics.
That's the thing about politics. I mean, I've been down in Washington because I live in Baltimore and had discussions. And one of the difficulties is that Yemen is a 20 to 30 year problem. I mean, we have to have a long term vision of the building of a Yemeni economy and politics that can absorb, you know, a rapidly growing population in a way that is stable. And the Washington thinks in terms of the next elections. And so it's very difficult to think long term. But that's the only way that Yemen's going to be solved. We can't think in terms of the next election. And we can't have our aid highly politicized as it often has been in the past. In other words, we've sort of held out and withdrawn, in fact, aid when the Yemeni government did things that we didn't like. And you can't think that way. You got to think in terms of, you know, a long-term building of economic and political capacities.
So it takes that long to do that, 20 to 30 years.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's very difficult for Washington to keep its eye on the ball for a 20-year program.
Right. Let's take one more call. We have about a minute left. Joelle from Madison, hi.
Hi there. I'm just wondering what is something the biggest maybe blind spot that our American point of view is not catching in the view of Yemen as a culture. What's the biggest misconception, and how can we change that?
That's a good question. There are a number. One of them is that Yemenis don't like Americans. That Yemenis are hostile to Americans. And actually, I saw that written a number of times in the papers. That there's a great deal of anti-American hostility. In actual fact, Yemenis love Americans. But what they're a little bit nervous about is the security measures that the military measures that the Americans have used. There's sort of a fear that Yemen, that Americans are going to come and sort of take their own measures inside of Yemen, which may not be in the interest of Yemeni people. As I said, there have been some attacks in the past that took out large numbers of civilians by American airstrikes, and so they're nervous about that. I would say another is that the issue of women, which is a whole other issue in the Middle East in general, but because Yemen is culturally very conservative, it's a republic, and they don't have the discriminatory laws that Saudi Arabia does. In fact, they have lots of very egalitarian laws. But because it is so culturally conservative, for example, the issue of child brides and whatnot, that we view Yemeni society as sort of these backward barbarian people, which they're not at all. And you know, this is where cultural exchange can be great. This is where you know, having students there, having people understand Yemenis, and having Yemenis come to the United States can be a great help in clarifying these blind spots.
Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our guest, Professor Charles Schmitz, he's in the Department of Geography at Towson University, and he's a specialist on Yemen. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Peace for producing this hour, to Chrissy for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. A reminder, tonight, 7 o'clock election coverage, and tomorrow, the full 2 hours, we will devote to what happens today as a result of everybody going to the polls. Okay? Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network.